Once you draw up, I'll put them up higher.
Well, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. This subject of the great passage has become recently important to me because I just passed my 63rd year, and there's a certain sense of mortality that comes into your soul. At least my experience was a certain sense of mortality came in that was actually quite refreshing in a certain way, having to do with the fact that maybe I don't have to freak out about the small stuff anymore, just really pay attention to the big stuff. And the big stuff is the great passage. So the great passage is from this life to the next life. The great question is, do I exist? Do I, as I know myself, still exist when I take the great passage, when I book passage to go across? Do I still exist, or do I lose who I am? Am I still who I am? If I'm not, how do I know that I am still? Or is that the end of it all? Is that simply, you know, fait accompli, fini, you hand in your sneakers and you're gone? Or is there something else? Is there what Rudolf Steiner calls the continuity of consciousness? And in the traditions, in the mystery traditions, it's always understood there is a continuity of consciousness, but it is not a given. It's not something that we get automatically simply because we have one consciousness here on earth. The mystery tradition says that consciousness is available to those who understand that they must prepare themselves for the consciousness of continuity. Those who don't prepare themselves for the experience of continuity will go into a world where they will have the experience that there is no continuity. Those who prepare themselves to experience continuity will go into a world where they have prepared a place for them to be. We could say a place where there is no place. And that theme of a place where there is no place is really what I hope to share with you in the work we'll do over the weekend, is what kind of place is that? Are there rules there? Are there things that I can rely upon? And most importantly, are there people there? Are there people who I love there? Are there things that I know there? Or is everything taken away from me when I go across the threshold? So I, even though I don't have continuity anymore, I'm at a total loss, a total non-entity in the cosmos. What a sadness to feel that when I drop my body, I no longer am an entity in the heart of God. What sadness. And for many, many, many people in our culture, that's exactly the experience. So the thought is, I have to have more marbles or SUVs when I die than anybody else, because at least I can say then that I've lived. But the idea of continuity of consciousness means that I always live. I just don't always live in a body. Or I could say, I always live in a body, but it may not be a physical body. And that, to me, is what I'd like to share with you, is first, what does it mean if I have a body that's not a physical body? Can I experience that? Is that a reality? Is it valid? Or is it just a convenient fable because I'm so freaked out about passing across a threshold? Our culture gives very little to support the idea that there is a continuity of my consciousness across the threshold. But the mystery cultures and indigenous cultures always understood that that was the case because their teachers and seers would go there to solve problems. We go to university or to a lawyer or to an expert to solve problems. But the real solution to the problem is in a highly altered state of consciousness that has total intent but zero content. And that's where I'd like to go with you to try to share some ideas about how we can structure that type of consciousness in order to make sense out of the Great Passage. Because the Great Passage has with it a tremendous sense of anxiety. So what I'd like to do to prepare for tomorrow, we have kind of Alpine Ascent tomorrow. There'll be 5 lectures. So put on your seatbelt, you know, and just kind of go for it. So I'd like to, for those of you that don't have anthroposophical background, I'd like to paint a broad picture of what some of the parameters are and what some of the issues are around the idea of what we could call sleep as the little brother of death. That's an ancient mystery saying. Sleep is the little brother of death. And dream is how I have to form a body in the dream consciousness that becomes aware of the difference between sleep and death. There's a difference in degree, and how I structure my day awake consciousness to deal with my dreaming consciousness is the work of the new mysteries. It was the work of the old mysteries, but in that, the old consciousness, there was a kind of given that came from the ancestors to us. And now my understanding is we have to build back in the direction of the ancestral consciousness because we have a consciousness that has separated from it. It's no longer just a given that will be part of that consciousness because we have cell phones and we have all kinds of other things that give us the experience of being separate. And in fact, unless our separateness is honored, even though we may be part of a group, you better honor my separateness or I've got problems. This was not the case in the time when we were simply receiving from the ancestors. We now have to give back. And that requires a different kind of technology spiritually, we could say, or a different relationship between my soul and my spirit bodies. I have to explore them in a different kind of consciousness. So I'd like to give you an imagination that I hit a while back about the 4 bodies that Rudolf Steiner gives. He's following a theosophical tradition of the 4 subtle bodies. We could ask, what does it mean when we say a subtle body? It's a really good question. So I'd like to give you a picture of that by simply describing a river. And hopefully this will enable you to have a sense of how you can think about what I'm going to present tomorrow. So a river is composed of many different subtle bodies. Some of them are not so subtle, like the physical body is the least subtle. The physical body of the river is the earth that the river is living in, the banks of the river. It's physical because it provides resistance. Your physical body provides resistance for your soul's spiritual body and allows for certain interactions to happen. It provides a kind of grounding or root for the rest of the subtle bodies. And in the case of the human, is the basis for the arising of the consciousness of, as they say in philosophy, me positing myself. I have to have a part of me that says, I am here. Because there's a whole part of me that says, I am that. In order to survive being that all the time, I have to have a part of me that says, I am here. It's a kind of a grounding. The grounding of the river is the ground that it flows through. And that ground provides resistance. The grounding of the human, my physical body, is the matter that is caught in my soul's spiritual life body. It provides a kind of grist for the mill of my soul life and allows me to say, this is my body. This is my, here's my hand, these are my shoes, these are my car keys, this is my bank account. Extends out of my experience, this is my body. I sort of extend my body experience to everything else. Okay, so if I really want to understand my real body experience, it's none of the my car keys or my bank account. It's just what meets my chair. So the part of you that is having an interaction with your chair that is probably below your level of consciousness is your physical body. And the part of the river that is creating a kind of resistance to the flow is the physical body of the river, we could say, the banks of the river. But the river itself is not the banks. The river is the water that is flowing through the banks, and in us, the river that is flowing in us is the life body. Rudolf Steiner calls it the ether body, the life body. And it's the body where in me, it's a subtle body. It's a body that's continually flowing and moving and changing. All the chemistry of my digestion and my glandular secretions and all of these ebbs and flows of fluids and relationships of this changes into that through molecular reactions, all those kinds of things. That, if we could peel all that out and see all that energy and see it, imagine it, we could somehow peel it out and look at it, it would be a kind of ghost-like figure that Rudolf Steiner calls the ether body. And in the river, it's what's flowing. And in the river, we have all the laws of the flow, the vortex formations and all of this kind of stuff, and streamlines and subtle membranes and energetic transfer and all of that that keeps the flow of the river happening. All the chemistry of things that fall in the river and die and then get assimilated in oxygen and, you know, the fish interacting with it and all the tadpoles, all of that is a life or the flow. It has to do with the flow. So in us, I have a subtle body that's continually flowing. If I have a consciousness of it, I begin to penetrate into my ether body. We'll look at that in detail tomorrow. I just want to give a picture and characterize it now. Life body. My life body is separate from my physical body. Because my physical body forms compounds and then parts of it falls off. My hair comes out, my skin falls off, stuff comes out of my mouth and various orifices. The stuff that was part of me that becomes physical dies out of my life. But my life continues. So there's a part of me that is not living and a part of me that's living. The part of me that's not living is my corpse. That will go to the earth when I pass away. A part of me that is living in the corpse and animating it, but when that goes away, that goes back into the natural world, into the elemental world, and that, as I understand it, was the real source of the tradition of the realm of the ancestors who live in the forces of the flowing sap in the tree and in the plant and in the clouds and in the water and in the growing things and the wind, all of these movements and flows and exchanges in the natural world. The ancestors live in those forces in the life ether of the earth. That's part of us goes there when we pass away. Goes back into that body of forces. In the ancient traditions, there was direct access to that through the life body of the people because they lived in that. They were living so close to it. They understood that language. It just lived in them. So that's where they found their understanding. The life body. It's a source of clairvoyance. But when I fall asleep, my life body, the flowing part of me, the chemistry, the secretions, the responses to sense experiences, and my physical body, the actual substances in my physical body, are united in such a way that they stay behind in the bed to get refurbished. My liver goes into life mode. All my organs kick into another modality, anabolic rather than catabolic, build up rather than break down. And I suddenly emerge out of sleep with new forces. And the reason why there's a separation is it's not my life body that creates the condition where I have to go to sleep. My life body is continually living. My physical body is carried along by the continual life of my life body. Beings of the ancestors living in that support that and give me my DNA and all the forces that live in me. My life. But my life never gets tired. And my physical body is not afraid of death. I can take my arm off and through an operation and put it over there. My arm is not afraid of going back to the earth because it came from the earth. It goes back to mother. No problem. But a part of me is upset about dying, but not my physical body. And my life body isn't upset about dying because it deals with dying all the time and it says, what do you mean dying? You're living. Hello, get up and go to work. Eat this, digest this, move here, move that, cry, laugh, do things. My life body gives me the forces to do it. So my life body's not really afraid of dying. But there's a part of me that makes me very tired. And that part of me is what Rudolf Steiner calls the soul body or the astral body. Because the soul body is where I separate myself from the realm of the ancestors and say, you know, this is me here. And this is me with my ideas and my dramas and my loves and my not-so-loves and my issues and my stuff and my beliefs and all of that. It's my issues and my beliefs and my stuff. That's what makes me tired. My soul makes me tired. Because it's where the work is done. I need to change the way my soul impacts my life body. But it's in my soul that I'm afraid that I'm not going to have my life body and my physical body when I go on the other side. Because guess what? I won't. My physical body goes back to the earth and my life body goes back into the realm beyond the beyond. And I still have this residue of, well, what about me? That I've managed to pull away from my life force and make an independent consciousness. And that independent consciousness is the one who expects there's going to be a download at the end of the day. There's something in it for me. And that is my unique individual destiny, which is independent of all the ones who have come thus far. Except for who I was before I came here. Because then I'm just picking up the thread. And that's a kind of a new version. And that's the new mystery. Say, you know, you have a body that's independent that is causing difficulties with your life body and your physical body. And that's because of, in your soul body, you have the beliefs and the attitudes and the issues. And they have to do with you, not with us, you. And so in the river, what happens is the river's flowing and pulls off pieces of the banks. And then when it slows down, little pieces of the banks fall out and become sandbars and all kinds of stuff in the river. That's the astral body of the river. It's the stuff that falls out when I'm not active enough. When I slow down, when the water slows down, the silt that it's carrying falls out. It slows down at a very specific spot when it starts to turn and the silt falls out and builds up a pile. That's a sandbar. Eventually the sandbar builds a bank and starts to eat into the other side, and then you get the moving of, quote, the river back and forth, having to do with where the sand is being deposited and where new resistance is forming. But the sand itself becomes the physical, but the deposition of the sand and the arrangement of the sand is not just because of the physical. It's because things are happening in the whole river. Suddenly we get a lot of rain in one end, and then we scour out all the rocks, and suddenly that sandbar that was there is gone. This is called midlife crisis. I get my sandbar scoured out by my beliefs, by my wanting to hold on to them. That was my favorite sandbar, man. You just took it right out of my river. Well, we thought you probably needed to change it because nobody could get by it. There's no more life force left at that part of the river, so we needed to kind of just blow it out of there. So we had a big storm. It's called marriage counseling or something, you know. And you had the storm, and now you blew it out, and now we can move our canoes in it. Yeah? The astral body is the place where the storms happen. The place where the big change events happen. The place where it gets slow and stagnant, and the place where it gets quick and all of that. And that has to do with not just that particular place, but the whole river. So your astral body doesn't just have to do with this particular life. It has to do with you as an entity who has lived multiple lives. You as an entity who will need to live multiple lives in the future so that you can make up for what you did in your multiple lives in the past.
So then why do you say it's not carried on? If you believe in karma and the carrying on of the soul personality, why do you say that this is not carried
on? Okay, your personality isn't carried on, but your true self is carried on. I'm coming to that.
Okay.
So, and this is what just why I'm going through this little deal here, because we need to make a distinction. There's one thing that we're missing. So now we have the river with the banks, the water, and the sandbar. We have the physical body, the life body, ether, soul body, astral. We have one more layer to us, and the river has one more layer. So in the river, we could say, okay, here's a sandbar in the water, but why is there a river anyway? How come it goes, the astral body of the river goes from the beginning of the river to the end? Well, what you never really think about when you look at a river, unless you happen to continually want to do this, is that the water is moving because of gravity. It's always going downhill. It's a constant force at every place in the whole river all the time, moving down to the sea. From the very first drop that falls out of the clouds to when it goes into the ocean, it's going downhill. And that's a constant force at all points, acting on all points. Well, in my biography or in a human biography, the gravity is the perspective that your true self, your I being, has on why you're living your life as a little section of the totality of your life. In this particular life, your personality rules. But in your being, your I-being rules, and your personalities come and go just like taking a coat and putting it on and taking it off. So I need to make a distinction between my true self that understands my destiny and my soul and astral body, which understands my expectations of what I think I need in this life. Those are two different subtle bodies. And as we go along, I'll give exercises for these so we can actually try to look at them. It's rare, unless I have training, that I actually want to go up into the true self, because the quality of the true self is gravity, and the true self says to you, why are you doing this? To your personality. And your personality usually has a bunch of reasons why, usually having to do with bank accounts and attitudes and stuff, and the true self is going, but, you know, this happened before. The I-being is saying, on the 23rd, you did that same thing, and then here you did the same thing, and you did the same thing, and you did the same thing. And when you did all that, you know, this is what happened. Remember that? So why are you doing it? And your personality goes, well, you know, it's my life. I'm like living my life. And the true self is going, but think about the big one. And when you think about the big one, the personality shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And you start to see a picture of yourself as you wish you could be.
I probably shouldn't have used the word personality, because I was referring to personality as it's held on the Hara line as a soul personality.
Is it what?
That's a conversation.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The persona comes from the Greek, the mask in the theater. That's where the word comes
right,
from.
Right,
yes. It means I speak through it. Persona, I sound through it, yeah? Who is sounding through it?
Well, that depends upon how connected you are with your true self.
With?
Your true self.
Well, if someone's sounding through it, my personality. Who is that? It's not my personality, because my personality is being sounded through. So there's a part of me that transcends my personality, that has the big picture. And that's this I-being, or the true self. And that's the force that's acting in this life, but was also acting in the past life and will be acting in the future life. That has continuity. My soul, especially the lower members of my soul, don't. So I have to train my soul to get in line with my I being. That's called mystery school. Okay? And when I do, the parts of my soul that can't get in line with my true self, they have to go through some refurbishing. That's mystery training. I have to say to my personality, do you really need that? And when I do, I'm asking myself, and usually the answer is, well, I like it. Yeah, but do you need it? Well, I like it. And therein comes the issue, can I do the work? Okay, so I have these, and there are other bodies that are even more subtle than that, but this will do it for us right now. Okay, so the reason why I went through this was to say, if you go out and look at the river, or you look at the ocean, you usually don't think of gravity. Unless you live around here, maybe you think of the tides, you know, but the river's going. But the gravity involves the moon and all kinds of stuff, but all we see is the river. When we usually look at ourselves, we don't see our true self or our I being. We usually just see the personality, the one who is here doing things and making jokes and having attitudes and dramas and stuff like that. But there's a part of each one of us that doesn't have to have the drama. And that's the part that will go through the great passage. That's actually the ship that carries us through the gate. And then when we're on the other side, we have a whole other perspective on the way things are arranged. That's what I'd like to share with you tomorrow, is how can we understand that? What happens when we drop the personality? Do we cease to exist? Or is there something else? There is something else, but usually we don't want to hear there's something else because it seems like a whole lot of nothing. But the irony is, when you actually find who you really are, you become a whole lot of less than nothing. And that becomes one with everything. In order to become one with everything, you have to become less than nothing. And when you do that, suddenly you awaken in a consciousness that is huge, huge, and can give you the courage to get up and go out and do your work. But in that consciousness, you are technically dead. You have gone through the great passage. And when you are in that consciousness, it takes a little bit of working to be okay with that. Because normally when you go there, your body goes, hello, I think you're dying, so let me give you an itch, and let me give you upset stomach, and have anxiety, and a bunch of thoughts, and, you know, as a fail-safe. But it's because your body isn't used to doing that. And your life body is going, hey, wait a minute, is this checkout time now? I still want, you know, I want to take a shower. And it sends all these messages. But your true self is going, come along, come along, come along. It's okay. You're still here. You're still intact. You just don't have any of your toys. You left them back there. But it's still you, and there are new toys. In fact, you are now a toy. So you don't have toys, you are toys. In fact, there is not nature out there. You are now nature. Then we get back to the second level of being in the realm of the ancestors. I consciously become that. That's down the road. Okay? So that's, I just wanted to give a little picture of the bodies so that if I use the language, at least we have some pictures we can refer to if there are questions. Now, in the middle here, we have the physical body, life body, soul, and I, or true self. There's this quality between the physical body and the life body form a unit. And the soul body and the I being form a unit. And they are joined together when I am in an awake state. I'm here, I'm speaking, my destiny is kind of moving through me because I'm here and you're here and this is part of karma or whatever. That's the ego level or the I level. And my soul is here with all my sandbar stuff, all my issues and ideas and who I think I am and, you know, blah, blah. And my life body's here, digesting a wonderful meal and trying to get energy to speak to you. And my physical body is keeping me all intact like an envelope. But when I go to sleep tonight, or if suddenly I were to check out in front of you, my life body and my physical body would go down on the carpet here. And my soul and my I being would go somewhere else and you would not have a speaker anymore. Because the part of me that is speaking to you and the part of you that is listening to me are not really part of my physical sheath. They really, all that meaning and all that information is really a soul spiritual realm. I'm just using a vehicle and you're using a vehicle so we can say, oh, here we are, are we having a good time or not? And so the reality is that my physical body and life body are only loosely joined to my soul spiritual body and my I being when I'm awake. They are together. But all I have to do is start to daydream, and they do a process called loosening. All I need to do is get into my digestion, loosening. I have a couple beers, loosening. I start chanting until I go in an altered consciousness, loosening. I walk up the mountain until I kind of start to see funny little things, loosening. So every time I stress the connection between my life body and my soul by doing certain practices, I can hyperventilate, loosening. When I lived in New Jersey, I was on a tree nursery, and there was a young man there who had a lot of problems, who lived in one of the houses on the tree nursery. And he was in the habit of going down to the little deli on the corner and buying a six-pack of Pepsi on Friday night. And he'd go out in the tree nursery and chug six bottles of Pepsi and be a total, whoa, hello, for the whole weekend. It's a cheap high. But that's how he did it. His blood sugar went, whoo, somewhere, and he checked out and became a whole other person. Talked in, you wouldn't say, I want this. He would say, Bobby, want this. He was 20 years old. Bobby doesn't want you here. It's like, okay, Bobby, I guess you had your sixer for the weekend of Pepsi-Cola. Okay, loosening. Loosening, loosening. Some people get loose simply by eating something they're allergic to. Carl Jung, Bill W. was a correspondent of Carl Jung. They knew each other. They wrote letters. There's a wonderful letter where Bill W., a guy who found 12 steps, says to Carl Jung, what exactly is alcoholism? And Carl Jung wrote back and said, alcoholism is an allergic reaction that the alcoholic has to alcohol. It's an allergy. So, allergies, loosening. Fatigue, loosening. So, some people eat sugar, loosening. That's called diabetes. And so when my soul spiritual and my physical life separate, I have a consciousness like I'm not awake. A part of me is in an altered state. That loosened state, when I don't know quite how I'm connected in the right way, and I'm a little loosey-goosey, I come back in, I go back out, I come back in, daydreaming, whatever. Yeah? That loosening state is actually a dream state. It's not my awake state, and it's not my sleep state. It's an interface between the bodies, and the degree of loosening and the quality of loosening and the intent of the loosening is what the ancient mystery schools were made out of. I can hit my heart and say yalalu for a half an hour, and I am definitely loose. And then people can suggest to me that I need to do things. That's the way they used to train assassins. To do things. They give them a little hash. Hashishin, assassin. That's where the term comes from. I give them some hashish and say, hit your chest until you start to excarnate a little bit. They give you a mantra to do. And then they'd say, you need to go and do this. And then you'd go and do that. So this all comes under the rubric, what we would call loosening. And so the control of loosening requires that we come to grips with the dream. We have to say, Am I dreaming now, or am I in an awake state, or am I kind of drifting through dream all and maybe into sleep? I have to become a kind of expert at monitoring how the dream quality is working in my lucid condition. That's what all the practices and meditations and concentration exercises and imagery and alchemical symbol stuff and, you know, all of that is to train myself to say, oh, gee, I think I'm in an altered state now. I'm loose in this particular way, but okay, here I'm using this symbol. Oh, I'm loose in that way, because there are a zillion ways to get loose. I just tried to give you a couple dozen of them, depending upon your tradition. Are you going to spin on one heel for half an hour? Loosening. You're going to drum all night? Loosening. So however the loosening happens, the technique is always that somehow when you get loosened, a dream arises where there used to be a day awake state, and you need to monitor what's going on in the dream. That then becomes the tradition that you're working in. So I'd like to give a picture here of a couple different states of dream, because it's really important when we get to the idea of the Great Passage, especially in a kind of modern mystery school. I need to be able to say where my dream is happening so that I can check myself. Tomorrow we'll do a process called disputation. It's a wonderful thing. It's so you can find out what you believe in. Is what you believe reality, or is it just an image? This is the hallmark of trying to get clear about this. So Steiner has a category of what he calls an organ dream. If I have a particular allergy, say I have an allergy to alcohol, and I do a bunch of alcohol, my liver is the organ of choice that's going to have to deal with that to begin with. Has to catabolize that and metabolize that and say, it's like, what is this? Where did this, something die down there? Because alcohol is a product of the kind of a death process. It's embalming fluid. So when that gets in the blood, the liver is going, I think we got something coming in here that looks kind of different than what I understand it to be, so I'm going to have to tag it and deal with it and put it over here, and then I get active and working. And then I do that, and then I go to sleep. That's right. And then I go to sleep. And when I go to sleep, what's happening... It's good background music for sleeping. It's great. Okay, so then I go to sleep, and my liver is going, you know, but you still got this stuff going on here. I got to process this, and, you know, what's going on? And it starts to create a field around it of its function. And what we don't really realize is my soul body, is monitoring during my awake state how my life body is doing. And my life body, a lot of the activity in my life body is composed of the dreams that my organs are having. This is what makes you hungry or what makes you thirsty. It's not you. It's your liver going, I had a dream. And you need to go drink some water, dude. Yeah? It's a dream. And it rises up, and what do? You go get some water. And you say, I got some water. But your liver's going, I made him do it. Because your liver dreams it in a consciousness that's so far below our day-awake state, we don't even have a clue. But if we could go there, if we could practice going there, and we could listen to that, we could become aware of the subtle changes in that organ as I begin to do different substances. This is all your doctor is going to tell you to do if you have to go on a diet. So you need to pay attention to your organ dream. Because this one's out and this one's over here, and we've got to bring them back to talk to one another in a better way. So don't eat this, because this makes you do this, and you go, oh yeah, I feel that one. That's a dream. It's not you. It's your... The hierarchies that stand behind that organ are saying, this is what we need to do to process what you did. And then you experience it as a picture arising in your consciousness, and you go get a drink of water. Steiner calls that organ dream. And it's the way the life body impacts the soul through another kind of division of the soul he calls sentient body. If you know that language. Sentient body is designated to pay attention to organ dreams. And the sentient body, the time that gets developed in the soul is adolescence. So the adolescents are totally focused on their organ dreams, usually a little kind of kinky ones. Yeah, because suddenly they're tuning into a level of their biology that's kind of cool. That wasn't there before. So we call it testosterone. That's a dream. I take 2 parts per million testosterone and tell me, guys, is that a dream or what? Definitely a dream. Yeah. Right? So that's when Steiner says organ dream, he's talking about codified patterns of soul responses and pictures that move in a particular way that I'm not particularly in contact with or in control of whatsoever. They happen when I eat something, when I smell something. Oh yeah, I remember that. That's a dream. And it's a dream coming from a particular organ that's been stimulated, and I call it me. But it's really not me as a true self. It's me as a soul being who is under the influence of the dreaming consciousness of my life body. If we want to get technical. And so, when I go to sleep, most of my dreams are organ dreams. They're just processing things that happened during the day when my organ took a hit or had this or whatever. And then at night, my organ goes, boy, did I have a day. This is what happened to me. And then it comes up in me as a dream. And it's so that the organ can get rid of all the tension and all the weird stuff. And then the liver resets the clock and the kidney says, okay, I need to do this. And then the heart goes, oh, this is what's happening there. This is secreting now. Okay, we're back in homeostasis again. Okay, it's 6:30, time to get up and do it all over again. And there's just that little moment when I'm about to kind of go in where my soul spiritual comes back and says, okay, so what happened last night when we did the detailing on that liver over there? Oh, that's what happened? All right, we call that a dream. Oh, did you process that? The hierarchies go, yeah, we processed that. We flushed that all overboard, and this is what happened. Then I wake up and go, whoa, that was wild. That's an organ dream. Now, some people specialize in monitoring organ dreams. So before they go to bed, they do a practice like, remember seeing your hands. This is Don Juan and Castaneda. Find your hands before you go to sleep. I find my hands. So when I'm in my dream, I go, find my hands. I find my hands. And then as I find my hands, I reconnect my soul spiritual to my physical etheric, especially my etheric, and I can monitor that. And then I say, well, hey, man, I'm here. I found my hands. I can control that. I can move this over here, I can move that over there, but it's then we call it a lucid dream. If you have a lucid dream spontaneously, it means that you have a little bit of a disconnect in the way the bodies fit back together again, and your soul is very aware of the disconnect as you come back in, so you go into rapid eye movement space, and says, whoa, boy, you had this, you know, this thing is happening here, and you know, maybe, remember when you got in that accident on your bicycle and you kind of did that? Well, you know, things aren't quite lined up the way they could be. And so you come back to your body and you feel kind of locked out from it because you can't just slip into it anymore. So you start having the experience like you're kind of caught up here and you're looking down at your body in the bed. And people practice doing that. It's all kind of, you know, you can have the Llewellyn books if you want about how to make the cord come out of your navel and form the double above you and float away and all that kind of stuff. And if you want to do that, that's okay. But that's called lucid dreaming. And the thing I'm going to try to describe to you is not lucid dreaming. Because in lucid dreaming, I'm dragging my soul spiritual back into my physical. And I actually don't want to do that. Because that's kind of like saying, I don't want to really die to myself. I don't want to really go there. I want to have this little bank account of things where I can do things in my dream because I'm connected to my life body in a different way. I can kind of, in the Russian tradition they call that, I get around paying the debt to the Father God. Meaning I found a way to, a loophole. So lucid dreaming is there's a kind of disconnect. Or if I do it consciously, I found a kind of loophole to make a disconnect. And I can do things. The question is, you know, are the things that I do in line with my soul or in line with my I being? If you read the literature, there's not a lot of talk about the I being in the people who practice lucid dreaming. It's a lot of talk about the soul. But not a lot of talk about the true self that goes between lives and the destiny of that being. So in order to go there, we have to begin to experience what we call significant dreams. And significant dreams happen in line with the way the new mysteries work. You can't petition for a significant dream. You can't orchestrate a significant dream. You can't manipulate for a significant dream. All you can do is prepare. And then if the spiritual world needs you to have a significant dream, you have a significant dream. And in a significant dream, you awaken to the fact that you are asleep, but you are awake, but you're asleep, but you're awake. And if you have them and they begin to have that experience of being regular, and tomorrow we'll talk about how can we can set up to petition for those things, how can we set up a condition so that we become a little sensitive to where that place happens, where you go to the altar, you place your begging bowl every day. How can you do that? That's Rudolf Steiner calls it the Rückschau, the daily review, the backwards review. You can begin to hang out by the door and place your begging bowl there every day, but you have to be completely have complete equanimity as to whether or not the bowl gets filled or not. Because sometimes you place the bowl there for years. And it never gets filled, and then you go, maybe I'm not, bam. So there's a different kind of rule operating on the other side now when I get my I being and my true self hooked into this. My true self says, you know, it's a really big life. It's not just what can you gather here and what kind of cool things can you do here. It's what can you do to get out of your own way so that things can happen that seem to be in line with where your true self knows you are going. That's the great passage. So the forming of my consciousness in an awake state and a dream state includes rhythms. I'll give you a couple of rules for it as we go along, and the great paradox. There are a lot of indicators on how to position, how can I position myself so that I become aware of how the door between this world and the other world is swinging open and closed all the time. There's a kind of rhythm that is happening all the time. And the technique that I'd like to share with you is, how can I make my consciousness rhythmic so that it can begin to participate in the great rhythm of my true self rather than the small rhythm of my personality? How can I do that? How can I make it receptive for the larger rhythmic structures that I need to tolerate in order to do this work? And so those larger rhythmic structures that I learn to tolerate will give me the capacity to face the future where uncertainties will be maximized. And we can see it around us starting to take off now. You know, used to be, you go to work for a company and they take you and then you have a retirement fund. How many have a retirement fund now? I used to have one, but I don't know anymore. Okay. My parents' generation, it was a given. That's what you do. And then they take care of you. This is just one thing. Global warming. Economy. Okay. Uncertainty. So the great passage, the work on the great passage, is so we build a resilience so we can handle uncertainty without having to freak out. In order to do that, I have to face my own demise. So thinking backwards is a technique that Steiner uses to help a person unwind the knots that form in the life body during the day. The sandbar, there'll be a storm, the sandbar forms, and then the river's doing funny things. And then I have to somehow get rid of the sandbar, and I have to wait for a cataclysm to do it. No, I don't have to wait for a cataclysm. I can just go backwards through the thing that happened during the day and look at it as if it happened to someone else. And say to myself, whoa, that was an interesting thing that happened to you. Okay, what happened next? And when I do that, I touch into a part of myself that lives way in the future. A part of myself that I can only dimly touch into, who looks on the lives that I've lived and sees the value of the painful lessons rather than the resentment of the painful lessons. And that's possible to do. It's not probable and it's not usual. But it's possible. This is then the great bodhisattva Kanon, or Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva of compassion. I have to have compassion on my own failure. The Rukshal, the daily review, is a wonderful way to build that because I go, as I'm going backwards through my daily events, I look back at what happened. I went, oh, that was a big ticket item there. Okay, well, and what happened next? It's the same thing you would do to your 3-year-old who came in with an hour. Oh, I fell down. Oh, yeah, I give it a big kiss. Okay, are you feeling better? Yeah, okay, go out and play. But you don't understand. I lost $10,000 in the stock market. Oh, you did? Oh, you poor thing. Okay, I'll give you a big kiss. Okay, go out and play. Wouldn't it be cool?
Yeah.
Well, the Rukshal, that's the purpose, one of the purposes, but it's a really big one. And so that we learn to look at the stuff that happens as if it was your 3-year-old going, oh, I give you a big kiss, you feel better? Okay, go out and play. And the mood of that over time, over time, over time, over time allows you to take the really big ticket items that happen and go, oh, that was a really big ticket item, wasn't it? And you go, yeah, it really was. Oh, yeah, well, but that was weird. Okay, yeah, okay, go out and play. You build a reservoir of compassion for your own failure to meet the drama. Thinking backwards. It's the most powerful form of human consciousness, according to Joseph Chilton Pierce. The reason is because it doubles the amount of will in my thinking, in my consciousness. Not only do I have to remember what I thought forwards, but I have to actually concentrate to dissolve it backwards. Very powerful level of consciousness. When I think backwards, if I do my day, I get back to where I was before I started, and I'm actually very close to the threshold where I have the REM state, a rapid eye movement state. If you've ever thought about dreaming, why do my eyes move rapidly? They're following the movements of the lessons that I learned when I was going through, coming back in and trying to touch into my life body and my physical body. I was watching the little movie of how my organs were responding, and I'm tracking it with my eyes. There are centers in the brain, primitive neural cortices that have to do with emotional centers on the top of the midbrain. There's some of the first tracks that are laid down in the embryo, and they are right in the spot where the optical radiation goes back, and they control the movements of the eye muscles. So I'm having these emotional events in my limbic structure, tracking them. My eyes are looking at something, but they're closed, and I'm, quote, asleep. It's the most active consciousness there in the threshold. And what am I doing? I'm tracking movements. So when I think backwards and I get back to the space where I'm in the bed or I'm sitting there and whatever, and I'm about to wake up in the morning, I can actually intend my consciousness into that space and listen to what I would like to describe to you, the quality of the movement of that space. Tomorrow we'll actually do exercises to do that. But in that world, everything is movement. Substances are movements. Beings are movements. Ideas are movements. Qualities of consciousness are movements. Everything is movement. And I need to be able to build a repertoire in myself of how things move. When I do, I transform space into time. Something called telescoping time. I telescope space and convert it into a time by making images, sequences of images go back into the space where I was before I woke up.
Say that last sentence.
I'm telescoping time by taking pictures. Actually, during the rukshal, that's what I'm doing. I'm building a kind of momentum backwards to take it into the place where I was before I woke up. I'm placing into that space the reversed movements of what my soul did during the day. That goes into a place where there is no place. And I transform things that happened to me that happened actually in time, but now I have projected them into space because I have a physical body. I say, yeah, well, you know, I dropped my keys. Well, my keys are actually an event for some iron that happened to be in the form of a key now, but in 600 years it'll be in a landfill somewhere in Hoboken and be, you know, who knows, part of the, some spaceship, or I don't know. Where's your pen that you're working with now going to be in 20 years? See, that's It's in space now, but it's going to be in time then. It'll be a whole other thing then. It used to be part of a dinosaur or an ancient forest, and now it's your pen. And 200 years from now, it'll be something else. That's the reality. So when I start to get on, think backwards during the day and get back to the place where I started, I actually have a momentum and inertia that my consciousness is moving back across into the place where I was doing my rapid eye movement sleep just before I woke up. And I actually am participating in the movements of my soul before I am awake. If I practice that often enough, I begin to build a repertoire of the quality of those movements that then comes back into my day awake state as a kind of tincture of what I would do differently if I don't want to have to keep repeating that thing over and over again. Which would be cool. Kind of a neat thing if I, oh, that's the lesson I'm supposed to learn? Well, certainly I learned that lesson. Boom, and I learned the lesson. Well, that's, I don't know about you, but that's not the way I've worked in my life. Why do we have to keep repeating the same thing? It's because we have the abiding belief that they're happening in space. You have to disenchant space and move it back into time. You have to become time aficionados. Time travelers, surfers. Get a sense of how time changes in my consciousness. Time is plastic in my consciousness. If I'm waiting for the ferry and I'm bummed out, 2 hours is a hell of a long time. If I'm waiting for the ferry and I'm with my friend, 2 hours is kind of social time, right? You people live on an island, you know that. It's 2 hours. What's the problem? Yeah? The problem is not the 2 hours. It's the soul. Because 2 hours is 2 hours. If I just won the lottery and had $1 billion in my pocket, 2 hours is woo-hoo. If I just lost $10,000 in the stock market, 2 hours is like, oh my God. Yeah? Time. And it's because we hook it to space, because we have a physical body, that we get into the, this is my stuff. So the Rukshal is a wonderful, wonderful healing and a preparation for moving into the space of the dream to prepare and to build my vehicle and to put provisions in it and make sure all the, you know, the lanyards are in the way they should be and all the stuff. So that when I launch my ship and I start to actually consciously surf through my own consciousness, I'm not put off by the fact that I'm probably close to being dead when I do it. So as soon as I realize that, my body, my physical body, and my life body have to react, and they poke my soul like it was when I was in fifth or sixth grade, you know, and I get itchy and I poke the kid next to me with a pencil. Well, we do that to ourselves when we get close to the big mystery of, do I exist when I'm in the great passage? Thank you.